Chapter 8. Meteorite Mischief and Mitigation. Do you have an impending sense of doom that you will be unlucky enough to be struck by a meteorite? Or, even more consequentially, do you think Earth, as we know it, will end with the supersonic arrival of a giant flying rock from space? The effect of Hollywood disaster movies on the human psyche is hard to overstate here. But as you may have recently read, like perhaps in all previous chapters of this book, space-based material landing on Earth is a thing that happens. And if it hits you, or it is big, it will quite likely be problematic. As such, addressing the dangers and annoyances associated with flying bits of space rock is probably worth doing because, and I cannot stress this enough here, I don't want to miss a thing. Historically, people have not feared death by meteorite. The main reasons for this are, 1, only in the last few hundred years did most people become aware that rocks could fall from space, and 2, past generations had other, more pressing things to worry about, for example, avoiding cholera, famine, and/or oxen stampedes. However, modern humans widely understand that they could die from a flying rock, and many of us have loads of extra time to worry about such things. This combination, and the fact that stray meteorites are far more exciting to worry about than realistic issues like heart disease, car accidents, pandemics, or gun violence, means there has been a significant uptick in the death by meteorite fear department, which is why it feels prudent to address it here. Numerous stories suggest that meteorites have hit people, and many of these may be true, but unless the fall is witnessed by other people, recovered, and analyzed, the authenticity of such events can be difficult to parse, particularly given the financial incentives now realized for possessing a physical piece of such a bizarre event or the short-lived notoriety associated with human meteorite interaction. A list of many of the confirmed and likely events can be found in the International Comet Quarterly, maintained by the Earth and Planetary Sciences Department at Harvard University. This is certainly not meant to disregard other stories of meteorite strikes on people, but confirming such events is not straightforward. Certainly, an interesting addition to this book might be a list of the hundreds of deadly meteorite strikes, narrow escapes, and associated harrowing stories, but thankfully, this is not possible. Even generously, historical evidence of death by meteorites is thin. However, there is solid evidence of an unfortunately positioned cow in northwestern Venezuela that met an untimely end thanks to a direct hit from the Valero meteorite on October 15, 1972. This is not to be confused with the massive, approximately 3.8-ton Vaca Muerta meteorite, a meteorite found in the Vaca Muerta region of Chile, which translates to dead cow. This is incredibly confusing, but the Vaca Muerta meteorite almost certainly did not kill a cow, and the Valero meteorite almost certainly did. Clear? After seeing an intense flash of light and hearing a loud bang in the evening, three farmhands went out the next morning to investigate and found that one of their bovine buddies had been in the direct path of an approximately 110-pound, 50-kilogram, falling rock. It did not end well for the cow. But the farmer did report that what was left of the cow was butchered and eaten. Moving on. The best documented case of a meteorite impacting a human comes from near the small town of Sylacauga, Alabama, in 1954. On November 30th, Ann Hodges was enjoying an afternoon nap on the couch when a grapefruit-sized meteorite crashed through the roof of her home, ricocheted off a large wooden radio, and struck her on the hip. Even though it caused some serious bruising, things could have been worse for Hodges. She managed to survive a meteorite hitting her, and she became a minor celebrity in the process, which is far more productive than most of my afternoon naps. The celebrity was short-lived, and the events of Hodges' life after being struck were not necessarily all positive, causing some people to think the meteorite was a bit of a curse for her and her family. A more recent case of a person being struck by a meteorite comes from Umbale, Uganda, in 1992. The rather large Umbale meteorite exploded in the sky during its journey through Earth's atmosphere, causing a loud noise that was heard widely throughout the heavily populated area. The resulting meteorite shower covered over 8 square miles and resulted in over 330 pounds, 150 kilograms, of material being recovered, mostly by local military personnel. As discussed in Chapter 3, a sizable portion of the Umbale meteorite was ground up and used as a hopeful cure for AIDS, which was rampant in the region at the time. While many buildings were peppered and many falling stones were observed, the only strike victim was a young boy who was hit, luckily, by only a very small piece of the meteorite after it had bounced off a tree. Digging through historical archives, it is at least possible to get a sense of meteorite strikes and their direct effect on humans through the generations, even though it is almost impossible to confirm these cases so long after the fact. One very impressive list was compiled by researcher Kevin Yao and colleagues by looking through approximately 2,600 years of reported Chinese meteorite falls that have impacted humans or human structures. Yao came up with 7 events that resulted in human casualties, some of which were reported to have killed tens of thousands of people, although there are good reasons to believe the absolute numbers from the larger events are unreliable. Just uncovered in 2020 were 3 corroborating government documents written in Ottoman Turkish that discuss the death of one man and the serious injury of another from a meteoritic airburst that occurred in what is now modern-day Iraq on August 22, 1888. It is hard to argue that this is not a legitimate record of a human death caused by a meteorite, but the offending stone is yet to be located and verified. There are other reported and undoubtedly many more unreported, fascinating events such as these reports scattered throughout history, but most historians who keep track of such things likely would claim they have better things to do than comb through generation after generation of governmental records in various languages to find evidence of a truly obscure way of dying. Understandable. But even if we are extremely charitable to the records, known and unknown, and say that 50,000 people in all of history have died a meteorite-related death, then this would still be an incredibly rare way to die when statistics are considered. 50,000 people killed by meteorites would still be less than the number of people in the last 50 years that have died by falling off ladders. The threat is still real. Even though deaths caused by meteorite strikes are few, there have still been consequential events over the years that have raised some serious eyebrows when it comes to the potential dangers of rocks from space. Just as the dinosaurs. The first serious wake-up call to people and governments around the world happened in 1908 in what is almost the geographic center of Russia. The Tunguska event, as it is known from the name of a nearby river, is the largest impact event in recorded human history, although the event did not result in the formation of a traditional crater. The exact nature of the event is still unknown, but scientists largely agree that the massive explosion was caused by an airburst from a meteorite or comet. Seismic readings from the event were noted across Europe and Asia, and air waves from the blast were detected on the east coast of North America. The destruction caused by the explosion is almost unimaginable. It leveled almost 100 million trees over approximately 830 square miles, an area larger than 25 of the countries on Earth. It would have destroyed any major metropolitan area, and deaths could have been in the millions. Fortunately, the event happened in an incredibly sparsely populated area of Siberia, where only 3 people were reportedly killed, along with a herd of reindeer. Just like for Anne Hodges, things could have been much worse for humanity. Due to the remoteness of the location, proper study of the Tunguska event was limited, and scientific expeditions did not reach the site until 1921, 13 years after the event occurred. Damage from meteoritic material, particularly significant damage, is rare, so the fact that the Tunguska event did not spur much action may not be surprising, given its limited financial and human toll. And it was 1908, so technology was a bit more limited by today's standards. But Tunguska at least put the planet on notice of the dangers that lurk in deep space. Small potatoes and similarly sized rocks. There is nothing to compare with Tunguska in terms of damage, but there are numerous amusing stories from around the globe, like the poor mailbox in Claxton, Georgia, that got the meteorite treatment in 1984, and the Madrid meteorite that fell just outside the steps to the Natural History Museum and was collected by the director of the museum's Meteorological Institute. There was even a golf ball-sized meteorite that lodged itself into the home of a French family with the last name of Comit in 2011. And perhaps most famously, Peekskill, New York was the site in 1992 where a meteorite violently found its way through the trunk of a cherry red 1980 Chevy Malibu. This may have seemed like incredibly bad luck to 18-year-old Michelle Knapp, who had just recently purchased the car for $400. But time may have convinced her this was a blessing in disguise. In 2012, the broken rear taillight bulb and original car title sold for over $5,000, and the 26-pound, 12-kilogram meteorite currently sells for greater than $150 per gram on the open market. People love a rock with a story, apparently. One could go on for pages and pages about stories from meteorite falls throughout the years, and they are all interesting in their own right and chronicled in a number of places, but these were all inconsequential falls on a global scale. None of these meteorite impacts caused much global consternation or political dialogue about protecting our planet from flying rocks. But should we be more concerned about the dangers from above? The first step is realizing you have a problem. When scientists showed in the 1980s that the dinosaurs were eradicated by a massive rock from space, people started to get a bit concerned that our species could also go extinct in the blink of an eye. The U.S. Congress mandated to NASA in 1992 that they should locate 90% of the near-Earth asteroids larger than 1 kilometer within 10 years. The perils of planetary pinball got a bit more attention still when the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 slammed into Jupiter in 1994, releasing an amount of energy estimated at approximately 600 times the world's entire nuclear arsenal, leaving a truly massive scar on a truly massive planet. Just for some perspective, the world's nuclear arsenal at the time contained over 38,000 weapons, most of them many times larger than those used at the end of World War II. But it was not like we were actively developing a plan in case something similar was detected headed our way. The pair of 1998 movies, Deep Impact and Armageddon, were potentially helpful to raise the issue that we might want to think about actively forming a mitigation plan in case we found ourselves in the crosshairs. But these were just movies from Hollywood, so how serious should politicians take this idea? Luckily, scientists take it quite seriously and have been combing the skies for a while now, searching for what are known as near-Earth objects, NEOs, in an attempt to identify objects that might be on a collision course with our home planet. Many groups at universities and governmental agencies are dedicated to looking for particular sizes and types of NEOs that might become problematic. But the collective monitoring system is termed Space Guard. Awesome name. And has been scanning the skies as an affiliated group since the mid-1990s. This is named after a fictional space monitoring system in the Arthur C. Clarke science fiction book, Rendezvous with Rama. The issue got another major shot in the arm on February 15, 2013, when the Siberian sky opened, again, for the arrival of the Chelyabinsk meteorite. At 9:20 in the morning, the meteor lit up a large area of the sky brighter than the sun as the object careened toward Earth. The meteor exploded before it reached the surface, causing a massive airburst that shattered windows and damaged thousands of buildings in the area. This airburst caused far more damage than the surviving flying chunks of rock that then became the Chelyabinsk meteorite. Even though the area is a relatively sparsely populated part of Russia, the event still injured more than 1,000 people and caused well over ₹1 billion, greater than $33 million, in structural damage. The asteroid that caused the event, which had an estimated diameter of approximately 66 feet, 20 meters, was not detected until it entered the atmosphere. The day of the incident, the rarely heard from United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs suggested creating an action team on near-Earth objects, and the U.S. House Science Committee met shortly after to discuss how to deal with threats from space. Although it is possible the U.S. response was also partially because Congress gets extra nervous when Russia blows anything up, deliberately or not. Either way, following Chelyabinsk, NASA announced the Planetary Defense Coordination Office, whose mission it is to use applied planetary science to address the NEO-impact hazard. The office is tasked with finding and tracking all potentially hazardous objects larger than 30 to 50 meters, about twice the size of the Chelyabinsk offender, and to develop and coordinate strategies and technologies for mitigating any potential impactors to Earth. So, yes, it is basically a scientific version of the movie Armageddon, with all options on the table. Possible mitigation strategies. Natalie Starkey does a very nice job of describing a variation of mitigation strategies in Chapter 10 of her book, Catching Stardust, if you would like additional ideas or more detail about some of the ideas discussed here. So, what would we do if scientists located a large asteroid or comet headed our way? After instantaneously pooping our collective pants, there are two types of realistic strategies that can basically be classified into 1. Gradual methods, and 2. Sudden methods, where both methods are just as they sound. The gradual approach slowly changes the path of the object over time, diverting it from an Earth-crossing orbit. The sudden approach, well, blows the bastard up. Intelligently choosing between these options requires that we know a decent amount about the impending collider, such as size and shape, speed, and basic composition. Also important is the predicted time before it hits Earth. If we have multiple years to decades, we have a lot more options. If we have months to a year, well, sudden methods will be the only game in town. Either way, we also really do not want to make things worse. Having accurate measurements and good data are key to preventing us from pulling a rock into our orbital path that was not going to hit us in the first place, or blowing up a rock in which 20 medium-sized pieces hit us, instead of one large rock missing us. Let us assume we have detected a species-ending rock that we are sure is going to hit us in 10 years. How do you slowly change the path of a giant flying rock in space? The first step is to get a spaceship up near the object. After that, the most passive approach is to let gravity do most of the work for you. Since gravity acts like an invisible tether, the object is gravitationally attracted to the spacecraft once they are near one another. As such, thanks to gravity, you can slowly change the course of the spacecraft with gentle thruster bumps every now and again, ever so slightly dragging the rock along with you in space. This method is given the amazing name of the gravity tractor. Other more active options involve the spacecraft firing a constant stream of ions at the object to slowly divert it, or actively covering the NEO in some sort of white paint to change how it responds to solar radiation, ultimately resulting in a path adjustment. But these options all require years of preparation and years of action in space. What if we only have 1 year or 6 months before impact? Well, they most definitely did not make a movie about painting the side of an asteroid white. If you are as big of a fan of Atari video games from the 1980s as I am, you may imagine the active engagement strategies similar to either the game Missile Command, where the dangers come from rocks instead of missiles, and they are targeted from ground-based defenses, or, of course, the classic, Asteroids, where you fly around in a spaceship and try to destroy or alter the path of the troublesome rock. Well, congratulate yourself, and Atari, because that is about right. If Earth has a short time to act before we are obliterated, we fire something from the ground to hit the object and break it up. We fly up there to shoot at it, or, alternatively, we modify the gravity tractor into a real tractor and drag the asteroid or comet out of harm's way. This, of course, sounds like engineering fantasy. But lucky for us, planetary scientists are already hard at work testing some of these diversion techniques. In 2005, NASA successfully launched a small projectile and hit the comet Tempel 1 as it whizzed around the solar system in the Deep Impact mission. The mission helped scientists learn a ton about the composition of the comet, as well as acting as a proof of concept in case we must do something similar in the future to save our planet from destruction. The joint mission between NASA and the European Space Agency, ESA, called DART, Double Asteroid Redirection Test, acts as a follow-up on the Deep Impact mission, only on a much larger scale, with the goal to measurably alter the path of the binary asteroid Didymus. Other technologies that actively drag asteroids out of their current path are in the planning stages and will likely be tested in the coming decade or decades. This technology is being heavily supported by many newly formed space mining groups in hopes they someday will be able to drag an asteroid full of scarce materials into Earth's orbit to make it easier to exploit. It is unclear which, if any, of these planetary defense strategies will be needed while humans inhabit Earth, but it is an almost statistical certainty that our planet will be struck by a large asteroid or comet at some point in the future. It's just a matter of when and if we'll be around to care. If it's during our time on Earth, it would be nice to have the opportunity to fight back. And unless we invest in the detection capabilities, experiments, and engineering expertise that currently sound like science fiction, then we will be helpless to protect ourselves from the statistics of the universe. And if the possibility of saving all inhabitants on Earth by actively avoiding collision with a large asteroid does not qualify as a good reason to study space science, then there is little that will change your mind. Chapter 9. Modern Meteorite Research. The previous 2+ centuries of scientific research on meteorites opened our eyes to numerous incredible discoveries, from finding star fossils older than our solar system to helping us understand how planets form and evolve. But do we have it all figured out? Not even close. Through the study of meteorites, we may have already learned an immense amount about our stellar environment, our natural world, and the world constructed by humanity, but numerous avenues of meteoritic research are still tackling some very big and very interesting questions. How did the solar system start? We don't really know. Has life ever existed on Mars? Not sure. What types of environments are required to produce complex organic molecules? Good question. The exciting parts of life occur when you don't know what is going to happen. So I want to close the book on the fundamental thing I find most thrilling about science in general. There are a lot of fascinating questions that we don't yet have answers to, so we search for them. Below is by no means an exhaustive collection of the exciting things happening in meteoritics, but a list of the ongoing research questions in the field of space science that I personally find particularly compelling, and briefly, how they are being answered. Tracking the Fall of Meteorites. Technology to the Rescue. People often ask where meteorites come from. Every so often we get a chunk of the Moon or Mars, but the primary answer is the asteroid belt. But the asteroid belt is approximately 93 million miles, 150 million kilometers wide, contains approximately 1 million asteroids that are greater than 1 kilometer in diameter, and perhaps billions of smaller objects. So the answer of the asteroid belt, while correct, is incredibly vague. We can do better. On April 7, 1959, the fall of the Pribram meteorite in what was then Czechoslovakia was captured on film by multiple cameras at the Ondřejov Observatory, the first time this had happened. Capturing a fireball on film may seem like a cool but strange thing to want to do, but the benefit of photographing a fall is huge, at least in theory. First, if you are using a camera with a known shutter speed and you get multiple shots of the fireball, you can determine the meteor's velocity. Second, if you capture the fall with multiple cameras, you can triangulate both the meteor's starting and ending points. This means that if you could find the terminus of where the fireball was pointing, you could find a fresh meteorite. And a fresh meteorite is way more scientifically useful than one that has been lying around for a few thousand years. Additionally, triangulation permits back calculation of where the sample's orbit originated, meaning a far more precise answer to the question, where do meteorites come from? All the while giving us a much better handle on current solar system activity. After the film from the observatory was developed, researchers were able to put all those ideas into practice and mathematically recreate the Pribram fireball's terminus. And within a week, the team located almost 13 pounds, 5.8 kilograms, of the meteorite in the predicted area. They also learned its speed and calculated the general orbit of the sample when it was still cruising around space. Those are some seriously cool photography and math skills. A handful of subsequent meteorite falls have been captured on camera, with their trajectories triangulated, but advancements in digital photography and pattern recognition have made cool studies like this infinitely more feasible on the large scale. In 2005, using three remotely operated cameras spaced around the desert, Curtin University in Perth, Australia, set out to observe rocks falling from space in the wide-open landscape of Western Australia. The first major success using the automated camera network came on July 20, 2007, when a fireball was observed over southwestern Australia. After the highest probability fall location was calculated, the team recovered, within 100 meters of the predicted location, multiple fragments of the meteorite known as Bunburra Rockhole. I cannot stress enough how much I love Australian meteorite names. This not only proved the remote tracking system worked, but the team recovered a relatively rare type of meteorite shortly after it fell, learned its original location in the asteroid belt, and determined that the rock came very close to hitting Venus in 2001 on its tour of the solar system prior to landing down under. Since the fall of Bunburra Rockhole, the remote camera network has expanded from 3 to more than 50 fully autonomous cameras just in Australia. And multiple countries around the globe now watch an impressive amount of sky every night for new additions to our collection and a better understanding of where these rocks are coming from in the first place. But perhaps even more exciting, the project has also started tapping into, by far, the largest camera network on Earth. Smartphones. The app, Fireballs in the Sky, allows anyone to get involved in meteorite tracking by using app-reported sightings and locations to assist in tracking meteorite trajectories anywhere in the world. Tracking meteorites with cameras may not be the most groundbreaking science in the world. This was done first in 1959. But it is an absolutely fantastic way to get more people involved and excited about space science, at the same time leading to more and fresher meteorites being collected. Meteorites and anthropology. The Bronze Age, the bustling period following the Stone Age, saw humanity grow in remarkable ways. In fact, this age boasts several key human advancements, such as the invention of the wheel, development of writing, the start of widespread farming practices, creation of urban areas, the first system of laws, and the development of extensive trading networks across the globe. All occurred during the Bronze Age. But germane is the reason it was called the Bronze Age, and actually relevant for meteoritics. Humanity had figured out how to make and work bronze, but it had not yet figured out how to smelt iron, something found in abundance in meteorites. As we discussed in Chapter 3, this metallurgical hurdle meant that the only source of iron metal for most cultures was 1. From meteorites, 2. Obtained by trading with more technologically advanced societies, or 3. Making a local technological breakthrough, ushering in a new era for that culture. These options are vastly different anthropologically, and knowing the difference is vital to understanding the culture at hand. The first step in untangling this web is figuring out whether the artifact contained metal from a meteorite or not. Numerous artifacts in museums spanning the globe fit into this category of what is known as Bronze Age iron, and anthropologists would greatly benefit from knowing the source of these silvery sojourners. And while determining the difference between meteoritic metal and terrestrial metal is straightforward using modern mass spectrometers, museum curators are understandably reluctant to allow any destructive technique to be used on an irreplaceable artifact, regardless of how little material is needed. Luckily, this issue has begun to be addressed by a recently developed non-destructive technique called portable X-ray fluorescence. This technique allows researchers to analyze the elements present in the metal artifact, essentially by pointing a fancy X-ray gun at the object and measuring the secondary X-rays that are created. Critically, the metal ratios in the object, for instance, the ratios of iron to cobalt to nickel, can reliably differentiate terrestrial from extraterrestrial sources of iron. Since such non-destructive techniques have a far higher likelihood of being used on precious museum artifacts, we will likely soon be learning a good deal more about the trade habits and technological advancements of ancient cultures. Life on Mars? The great David Bowie probably expressed it best through song, but it is undeniable that lots of people are interested in the possibility of life on Mars. It is impossible to predict how finding life on another planet would change society, but it is sound to speculate that it would be a pretty big deal. Whether or not we ever find such evidence, meteorites certainly have played, and likely will continue to play, a major role in the search for life on Mars. As we covered in Chapter 6, the current climate of Mars is a bit on the harsh side. Surface temperatures can be equivalent to a pleasant fall day in New York City, but they can also drop to -240 degrees Fahrenheit, -153 degrees Celsius. The average surface temperature of Mars is a less than balmy -81 degrees Fahrenheit, -63 degrees Celsius, compared with 59 degrees Fahrenheit, 15 degrees Celsius here on Earth. And perhaps even more important than the chilly temps, Mars's thin atmosphere does not block life-devastating ultraviolet UV radiation. So extant life on the surface of the planet is highly unlikely. However, while it is unlikely that life currently exists on the red planet, recent research has uncovered the planet used to be far more hospitable. Mars had a substantially thicker atmosphere, as well as moving water, lakes, and maybe even a shave ice stand at some point in its past, making it reasonable to speculate Mars could have hosted life. But what would indicate evidence of past life on Mars, keeping in mind the missteps of previous claims of what looked to be fossilized microbes? One of the most important discoveries from the study of Mars in the last few decades is the overwhelming evidence that liquid water once existed on its surface. For example, researchers have found on Mars clay minerals that form in wet environments, like the bottom of a shallow sea or a lake. Importantly, many of these clay-rich areas have been left undisturbed for millions upon millions of years, meaning, if they did contain life in whatever form, traces of it should still be there to find. Here's looking at you, Perseverance. These clay-rich areas are prime targets for upcoming Mars sample return missions. And samples from these ancient water-laden deposits of Mars may even make it to Earth's laboratories for detailed study before I retire. What does this have to do with meteorites? If you're looking for evidence of past life on Mars, it is critical to know as much as possible about the environments on Mars over time. And a lot of this information comes from meteorites. For example, many Martian meteorites contain clay and other potentially biologically important phases that can form without interaction with any organisms. And once newly collected targeted samples that might have hosted life in the past arrive on Earth, work done on Martian meteorite clays will be critical for comparing geologic signatures and potential signatures of life. Additionally, the very same people who develop specialized techniques for microscopic imaging and invent instruments to measure chemical abundances and isotopic ratios that help detect life's signatures will be the researchers who are best prepared to study returned samples of Mars. Nobody can just step up and crank a home run off an MLB pitcher unless they have a lot of practice. You start against little league pitchers, work your way up through college or the minor leagues until at some point you are ready for Mars sample return. The scientific techniques used to study potential signatures of life in meteorites from Mars and samples from the ancient Earth are continuously being honed, and experts are gaining valuable experience to study difficult-to-interpret samples and improving equipment to do the job. This type of work has already taught us an amazing amount about life on Earth and processes on other planets. But there is little point in bringing samples back from Mars if we're not prepared to properly measure and interpret them. Did life ever exist on Mars? It is possible we may never know the answer, but we will certainly never know the answer if we do not search for it. Organic molecules. What came from space, and how do they form? For me, the realization that organic molecules exist at all in meteorites is mind-bending enough. But the fact that such a complex and highly diverse suite of molecules, including life-essential things like sugars, alcohols, and amino acids, exist in abundance in many kinds of meteorites is almost incomprehensibly thought-provoking. Researchers continue to identify and isolate organic molecules in meteorites at a dizzying pace. This itself is a fascinating area of ongoing study, as many of these organic molecules are unstudied since they do not participate in the life cycle here on Earth. Of the various types of molecules, amino acids, the backbones of all proteins and enzymes for life on Earth, receive extra attention because they could also be potential precursors to life here and on other planets. Can amino acids form in isolation in deep space conditions? Or do these more complicated molecules only form on the assembled asteroids or the parent body? What conditions are required for their preservation? And how do certain conditions alter the molecules once they form? Modern research shows that amino acid formation and preservation strongly depends on several factors. By systematically studying organic molecules and many types of meteorites that have experienced different temperatures and water activities, researchers are starting to understand potential preservation requirements. But they're also finding that the mineralogy of the parent body is also important. The Antarctica meteorite hunting trips are particularly important for learning about extraterrestrial organic molecules. Antarctic meteorites are generally very well preserved since the samples have not experienced high temperatures or organic contamination here on Earth. How these factors, which are slightly different on every meteorite parent body, impact the structure, formation, and preservation of amino acids is just starting to be understood. Based on the diversity of meteoritic amino acids that have been identified, there were likely multiple formation mechanisms at play in the early solar system and on meteorite parent bodies. But what were these mechanisms? We are still working on that. Another branch of organic research involves studying why meteorites predominantly contain the left-handed varieties of amino acids, the variety life on Earth uses, and whether this helped usher in the origin of life. Were these left-handed excesses created when the amino acids were originally formed? Or did they develop during the extended time on the parent body by long-term exposure to certain mineralogical and environmental conditions? We don't know yet, but laboratory experiments that mimic conditions found in space and on meteorite parent bodies could help shed light on this. Additionally, computational models of molecular structures and behavior will likely play a significant role in increasing our understanding of these exciting topics. We don't yet have a firm grip on exactly how organic molecules are created in space, or how they are preserved or altered in meteorites. But we know organic molecules are there in abundance, and we continue to search for the hows and whys while preparing for the implications that come along with those answers. And if you are interested in the origin of organic molecules, there are two space missions that are going to address some important questions in this fascinating field. Space missions, going to the meteorites. It may seem unfair to count some of the ongoing and upcoming space missions as meteoritic research, but what is building a ship to bring back samples of an asteroid if it is not traveling to the source of the meteorites before they come to us? Going to pick it up ourselves circumvents the luck aspect of getting samples we might want from a particular asteroid, and it eliminates any worries researchers might have about a meteorite being contaminated or altered during its time on Earth, no matter how short that time might be. And just like with Mars sample return missions, the people experienced at looking at meteorites will be the same people looking at samples returned from an asteroid. So, missions like these are incredibly relevant to the meteorite community. Sample return missions from places other than the moon are rare, but they have happened in the past. In 2004, NASA semi-successfully returned a collection of solar wind samples when the Genesis mission crash-landed in the Utah desert. 2 years later, the Stardust mission retrieved particles from the comet Wild 2, upending our understanding about the contents and formation of comets. In 2010, the Japanese mission Hayabusa returned a few grains of material from the asteroid designated 25143 Itokawa. For a sequel, JAXA launched Hayabusa 2 in December 2014. The goal of Hayabusa 2 was more significant sample return from a more scientifically interesting asteroid, one designated 162173 Ryugu. The return of material from Ryugu was accomplished on December 9, 2020, with the exciting successful capsule recovery. At the time of writing, scientists are currently carefully unpacking and sorting through the returned treasures in order to study them in detail, free from potential contamination from earthly influences. Akin to Hayabusa 2, and with an agreement to share samples between the agencies, NASA's mission OSIRIS-REx launched in September 2016 on its way to the asteroid 101955 Bennu. This particular asteroid, scientifically similar to Ryugu of Hayabusa 2, was selected for OSIRIS-REx because remote observations showed that it is highly enriched in carbonaceous material, very similar to the carbonaceous meteorites that contain abundant organic molecules. Following more than 1.5 years of orbiting, studying, and choosing the best site, OSIRIS-REx will sample and return approximately 60 grams or more of Bennu's pristine carbonaceous material to Earth for detailed scientific scrutiny, with sample return expected September 24th, 2023. If the plans for both missions go smoothly, the extraterrestrial organic-rich payloads of Hayabusa 2 and OSIRIS-REx will ultimately provide vital information about the source of organic compounds that led to the formation of life on Earth. Not a shabby scientific contribution. Planetary arrangement. Are we special? One compelling area of current research that combines astronomical and meteoritic study is understanding our solar system's planetary arrangement. We have known since the invention of the telescope that our solar system has the small rocky planets near the Sun and the gas giants, such as Jupiter and Saturn, farther away. But the recent discovery surge of extrasolar planets from our astronomy friends shows us that this organization is essentially unseen in other stellar systems. Most other stellar systems have gas giants very close to their central star, essentially swapping Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune for Mercury, Venus, and Earth. It is also worth noting that many stellar systems are binary stars. The famous double sunset of Tatooine depicted in Star Wars might not be that uncommon for other worlds. Why is our solar system in a totally different arrangement to most others? And was that arrangement consequential for the development of life in the solar system? If we see a similar arrangement to ours in a different stellar system, is there a higher chance that life may have developed there? This is, of course, a multifaceted issue that requires a range of experts in various fields, but meteorites can help contribute to this in an important way. We can use meteorites to reconstruct the primordial architecture of the solar system, basically to remap it to what it used to look like. As we talked about in Chapter 1, the structure of the solar system has changed a lot, particularly in its early days. The reason is that a young disk of gas and dust only has so much stuff to go around to build planets. Jupiter and Saturn formed early and sucked up a lot of the mass that was in the disk, essentially leaving scraps for the inner solar system. While there was enough leftover material for some smaller planets to form, the gas giants continued to grow, and gravity moved these behemoths around to find the most stable orbits with the Sun and one another, causing havoc for the runts trying to eke out a planet near the Sun. This is where meteorites come in. The smaller planetary bodies that were trying to form bigger planets were scattered throughout the solar system, from very near the Sun to the outer reaches beyond the gas giants. But now they all live in the same neighborhood, the asteroid belt. Because the meteorites we get come from the asteroid belt, when these planetary fails bump into one another and break off small bits, our meteorite collection represents material that originated throughout the solar system, not just where it currently hangs out. And it would be helpful to understand the formation and evolution of the solar system, and really cool, to know where all of that material was when it first formed, not just where it ended up after the big reshuffling. It turns out that meteorites have specific characteristics that can tell us where they originally formed. One very intuitive characteristic, but one of the least helpful for locating their source, is the water content of a meteorite. Water is incredibly common in space, but mostly in its solid form, ice. And regardless whether water is liquid or solid, it doesn't take too much heat to drive it out and off of a rock. As such, if a body is forming close to a super hot object like the Sun, it would not have a lot of water because the Sun is hot, and water doesn't stick around when it is hot. If a body has a planetary atmosphere, this can trap water vapor from leaving the body. For a variety of reasons, some bodies have atmospheres, some do not, so this complicates things further. Conversely, if a body is forming far away from its star, it will have a lot of water, since none of it would be driven off. This principle holds in general for the solar system. Objects like comets, which we are fairly sure formed really far out in the solar system, are approaching 100% water ice, and places like Mercury, which we think formed very close to the Sun, have very little water. The problem with using water content to cosmolocate where objects originally formed in the solar system is that it's easy to change the content of water, even on a large body. If a comet runs into a planet, it can add oceans worth of water. If a dry asteroid runs into a planet, the heat from impact can boil away any water that was there. So we need tools other than water content to figure out where planetary bodies formed originally. One of these such tools that is just starting to come online is something called paleomagnetism, which is, essentially, looking at a magnetic field recorded long ago. When the Sun was just getting started, it had an intense magnetic field. Much like magnetizing a nail with a bar magnet, the Sun imparted that magnetic field on objects around it, detectable by how different magnetic minerals are aligned. The closer the object was to the young Sun, the more intense the magnetic field that was recorded in the rocks. Unfortunately, this technique does not work on all types of samples and can be compromised if the rocks are not handled appropriately on Earth. But it does provide one way of quantifying how far an object was away from the Sun at the start of the solar system. Another such method of determining the distance from the Sun that a sample formed comes from our old friends, isotopes. More on isotopes and their many uses in the appendix. With the precision achievable by modern mass spectrometry, several recent studies have concluded that meteorites record a gradient in their isotopic compositions related to how far out they formed. This may be caused by heat in the inner solar system, able to evaporate certain phases, where the lower temperatures in the outer solar system means that these phases were not affected in the outer portions of the disk, similar to what happens with ice, only with higher temperatures. Or it may have something to do with how material was mixed into our cosmic blender, the spinning disk that became the Sun and planets. Whether scientists look at water content, isotopic signatures, leftover magnetics, or ideally a combination of all three, these location-specific fingerprints allow us to reconstruct what the solar system looked like at its inception. And as we untangle the jumbled mess of the asteroid belt to map the positions of the planetary bodies early in solar system history, we hope to learn its original structure to better understand its evolution and compare it with the structures we are seeing in other star systems. Solar system formation. Were we pushed? We know when the Sun formed, approximately 4.568 billion years ago, give or take a few hundred thousand. But what caused that to happen? What started the process of solar system formation? Or more broadly, why are we here? By turning our telescopes to areas of the Milky Way where other stellar systems are in the process of being born, we surmise that our solar system must have started as a massive cloud of gas and dust that collapsed to form the Sun and planets. But as we know from Sir Isaac Newton and our own repeated experiences with couches and Netflix, something at rest tends to stay at rest. So how, approximately 4.568 billion years ago, did we go from a massive stagnant floating gas and dust cloud to a rapidly collapsing disk that formed the Sun, planets, asteroids, comets, and eventually Jar Jar Binks? For the record, I am not claiming Jar Jar was a positive outcome, but he was a result of the initial collapse of our protostellar cloud, and, arguably, the start of the collapse of the Star Wars franchise. Did enough dust grains eventually just randomly bunch together, starting a gravitational domino effect that caused the Sun and planets to form? Or was our dust cloud nudged by outside influence? Calling upon outside influence to start the collapse of our solar nebula may sound borderline religious, but the shockwave from a nearby supernova could have been just the nudge needed to transform a diffuse, dormant nebula into a rapidly contracting protostar that would eventually be the sun. But how can we research something that happened before our solar system was even born? If the formation of the solar system began by the shockwave of a supernova, our cloud would also receive other parts of that exploded star. And those other parts could provide physical evidence we can search for in meteorites. Certain types of meteorites contain what are known as pre-solar grains, fossils from dead stars that can be found in the most primitive samples. Unfortunately, we do not really know when or where these pre-solar grains came from. We just know they exist, and they were around prior to the sun's formation. To find evidence of a particular supernova, one that may have triggered the collapse of our molecular cloud, we would need evidence of when that supernova happened. Lucky for us, supernovae provide us with just the tools to do this in the form of radioactive isotopes that are only created when a star so violently and spectacularly dies. In cooking, certain dishes require certain conditions. As a native of Kansas City, Missouri, I inherently know you cannot make mouth-watering, fall-off-the-bone barbecue ribs in a microwave. You must cook them slowly in a smoker at low temperature for the better part of a day. Similarly, some isotopes can only be created under certain conditions. And when a star blows up, it creates an environment with a lot of extra neutrons in a confined area. As such, this extremely high density of neutrons creates isotopes that cannot be created any other way. Because some of these isotopes are radioactive, they can act as clocks interred in meteorites, counting down from when that explosion occurred. Evidence of specific radioactive isotopes is precisely the evidence we would need to determine if a supernova were the reason our solar system started in the first place. If a star did blow up and seed our molecular cloud with radioactive isotopes, these isotopes would mingle with their cousins of the same element and would therefore be most easily found in phases of meteorites that concentrate that specific element. For instance, if you were looking for evidence of an isotope of iron that was produced only in a supernova, you would want to find phases that had a lot of iron in them to start with. This requires not only finding the right sample and understanding its petrology, but also chemically separating and measuring the isotopic compositions of multiple phases for comparison. Studies to this point remain inconclusive about whether our solar system was started from the shockwave of a supernova, but stay tuned. Meteoritics. It takes a village. The studies outlined above are research projects that have been ongoing in the community for years and will continue for years to come. In this sense, these are not necessarily special projects. Meteoritic research, and most of science for that matter, is a team sport. This type of research requires networks of experts in diverse fields working in tandem. And this is not just space missions that require thousands of engineers, flight specialists, and mathematicians. This statement is still true for strictly land-based meteorite studies. As an example, take the project of studying whether or not a supernova collapse was responsible for the start of our solar system. The basic concept is that we want to know how much of a certain type of radioactive material was present at the start of our solar system. That seems reasonably simple, but first we need to know how much of that radioactive isotope we might have had as a background and how much is produced in different types of supernovae. For that, we need scientists who model these explosions and predict how supernova remnants might mix into a molecular cloud. We don't want to be tricked by alteration in meteorites that may have happened in the last 4.5 billion years. So we need experts in petrology to make sure we are looking at the correct samples. We then need to take the best samples possible to experts in chemistry and mass spectrometry, who can isolate and precisely measure the elements and isotopes that are targeted. And this needs to be done multiple times on multiple rocks to verify the results. Incredible progress can be made by one individual on any given topic, but it often takes roomfuls of people with a variety of backgrounds and talents to make meaningful scientific progress on big questions. The science of meteoritics had a few false starts and essentially only sputtered along from its inception over two centuries ago until the space age brought the scientific value of meteorites into focus. This abbreviated time span means that only a few generations of specialized scientists have participated in the scientific explosion from studying time capsules of the solar system. What amazing things will we learn as a larger and more diverse group of researchers begin to study these rocks? Again, stay tuned, or better yet, get involved. To study meteorites truly is about studying origins, our origins on a habitable planet, and our origins as human beings in modern culture. Meteorites have played an outsized role in our journey to humanity and our understanding of how we got here, from the recycled atoms of an exploded star, to the formation of Earth, life crawling out of the ocean, or religious crowds worshiping a new deity. And all of this is meaningful to the project of being human. I'm just grateful we're all part of the journey.